I just wondering, you see, you were an Anglican to start off with. I just really wondered how you got connected with the Church League at all in the first place.
Because some of the Church League were very good disciples of Mrs. Pankhurst. They were militants. I think it was through one or two of those that I joined up. And then it really was the most extraordinarily mixed, valuably mixed body. And the Church League did, like the Actresses' Franchise League, was another example of a small league that did simply invaluable work in making sensible suggestions, in squashing cranks who would have been a grave embarrassment to the meeting, and in spreading the new ideas in circles that other people couldn't have reached.
I think I've spoken
in every cathedral close in England.
Yes.
And
did you join when you were in Manchester then?
I don't think I joined in Manchester.
Mm.
I think I didn't join till, in fact, I don't think it was formed when I, 1911, when I made the transit. And there was an Irish Protestant clergyman, a Mr. Green. I can't even remember his initials. And Mr. Green was the secretary, and he was one of the most sensible and people I ever met. It wouldn't matter what field he'd taken up, he would have been outstanding in it. And Mr. Green was extremely calm and logical, and he refused to denounce anybody, either the militants because they weren't violent or the suffragettes because they were. And we had Bishop Gore also, very important person.
Yes.
Bishop Gore was very good.
And you had the Reverend Claude Hinscliffe as well, didn't you?
I don't think Hinsley only came
in. No, Hinscliffe, the General Secretary, Claude Hinscliffe. Do you remember him?
What, who?
Claude Hinscliffe. Hinscliffe, yes.
Well, he and his wife were rather eccentric people. Mr. Green had a good deal of difficulty. I think he was the chairman of the executive. A good deal of difficulty in making things run smoothly. The Hinscliffes. I remember them. I remember them very well now, and they were very good. We had some excellent speakers.
When you say they were eccentric, the Hinscliffes, in what way were they? How were they eccentric?
They were very temperamental.
I see. Mm. Difficult to handle.
Difficult to handle. Mm. They would do excited, impulsive things and that offended people, and then it was a great job trying to reconcile them again. You know, the kind of thing can happen in a society. The Church League, it faded away when the war began, you see, of course. It became the League of the Church Militant.
That's right, yes.
And I left it at that stage because it got into, it's one of the sad things that happened, it had got into a group of people who were simply not in the least interested in the religious side and probably never opened their Bible in their lives, but found it extremely useful in giving them introductions for, I can't remember the particular crank that they were trying to advocate. It's gone out of my head now. I haven't thought of them for years and years and years.
Not Maud Royden. She wasn't a crank, really, was she? You're not thinking of Maud Royden, are you?
Maud Royden, I don't think she did us any harm, but I wasn't at all keen on Maud Royden.
Really?
No. She was not a wise woman at all.
Why do you think that?
And she was a great friend of a cousin of mine, Maud Royden, and I'd known her for years, but I didn't respect her judgment in the very least, no.
What made you doubtful about her? Why did you disagree?
Well, I mean, things had happened.
I see.
And she would... this is the kind of thing that happens. May I... would you shut off any record of
it? Yes, of course, yes.
You must distrust people who think they can reform the universe, you see. Because they can't, and they'll just make a mess of it. And drop some useful work they could have done. And Maud Royden's conduct with... it must have been... Did she marry him ultimately?
She did in the end, yes.
Yes, she did to the end, at the end. And but her conduct was extraordinarily foolish. Of all three of them, Mrs. Hudson, Mr. Hudson, and Maud Royden. And it would simply have led to chaos if we had got involved in an issue like that, that was even worse than the promiscuity now, because it was more fatal, you see. There was nothing but to do with be washed over Niagara if you once began to play with that those sort of issues. And so we weren't at all too keen on having Maud Royden. Some of our people were, and of course we didn't say anything, and some of them didn't and recognised it as a danger,
really.
You see. That's really what it amounted to.
But what did you do in the Church League? I mean, you were public speaker, were you then?
Yes, we went round and held the meetings, aren't we? We explained... I don't know if you've read any of the suffrages of the Queen's Hall meetings. Of course, they sound terribly, almost so simple, almost gaga. But people hadn't accepted these as facts, you see. I mean, I never went to a meeting, I think, either in a cathedral close or anywhere else. But some person, generally a woman, might be either... would ask me in public or detain me afterwards as I was getting into my taxi and say, did I realise there were 7 women to every man in the United Kingdom? And England would be so swamped by ignorant women voters that she would lose her international position and what would, etc., etc. And gently denied that there were 7 women to every man. They just didn't believe you. And that was the sort of level on which their controversy was conducted. Yeah. So we often had to go into very great detail. And we had a very educative experience once. A very, very brilliant WSPU speaker, Miss Mary Gawthorpe.
Oh, yes.
Know her. Oh, she was like a little fairy, a tiny little thing, very dainty, and I most unfortunately lost touch with her when she went to America. She died in New York. She was a school teacher in Leeds.
Yes.
And... she must have been a very good school teacher. Was she such a wonderful gift of exposition? She was extremely attractive speaker. She was very witty and humorous. Nearly all the mythical hecklings, you know, stories of hecklings really originated with Mary Gawthorpe. And the way she could win a crowd over was a riotous and hostile crowd. It was simply marvelous. And Mary Gawthorpe and I made great friends. And she asked if I would come for an official. I was waiting to get a job. And she asked if I would come through a week's or 10 days visit to Harrogate for raising funds and speaking in the big hotels there. So I said, I think it's the most unpromising suggestion I've ever heard of, Mary. And she said, oh, wait, that often means that it's the best. And she, hello. With Mary Gawthorpe.
And you were going to Harrogate. And
going through Harrogate. Mm. Well, I went round first and interviewed the people. And I was surprisingly successful. And I hadn't expected to have thrown out everyone, you see. One or two said, oh, no, they didn't think their clients would like it. They were all very polite. And I arranged that on the second evening we should have a little party after the meeting, you see, coffee, and we invited... There was the mayoress of Harrogate.
Oh, yes.
Was very surprised to be invited. She said she never got invited to the hotel, surprisingly. and my sister, Rebecca West, who was only 15 at the time, she was persuaded. She put up her hair and said, now don't I look 18? And she did, you see. And she was allowed to come round with us, and she sold the papers, and of course she didn't speak, but she interviewed many of the people, and she said it was one of the most valuable experiences of her life. You see, we were dealing with a class of person at Harrogate. It was for various kind of women's troubles, obstetric troubles, and gout, and some of the things like that.
Yes.
And they had a rich, idle, middle-class clientele that was totally as much as those girls in Jamaica was ignorant of current things and just knew what they saw in the paper's headlines. So I went round and we said we were WSBU, but you must remember, as I emphasized last time, the militancy was only a small part of their work, and much the greatest and most important part of their work, including this is where they joined up with the Fabian Women's Group, you see, was where they helped each other, was in direct speaking to the working class.
Yes.
Both on paper and on the street corners, and house to house calling from time to time, but chiefly at outdoor meetings which had never been held before.
Yeah.
And attracted people who had never regarded politics as anything but a sort of oppressive regime, yes, that if anything was to be resisted, as it,
yeah.
And certainly never didn't understand their needs. Mm. Well, we went on our tour, and it was the most tremendous success. And we got compliments from the chief constable. We got all the police on our side. They used to come to our meetings, and as spectators quite often. And we had all sorts of people who had never read, a serious book, almost probably. And but are of course people, all of them with a little circle of
interest. Yes, you were spreading the thing round.
Yes, that you've and are intensely resentful, naturally, of having big changes that they can't understand and feel they haven't been consulted in,
yes,
you see.
Yes.
And this was both the Church League and a good many of these little enterprises, Irish League and the invitations that arose out of the by-elections and
yes,
that sort of thing.
Yes.
They were all built up the story,
yes,
in a way that's been entirely missed.
Yes.
And it
what about men, Dr. Fairfield? Did men support the suffragettes at all?
Men?
Yes,
oh, we had a lot of very, very good men friends.
Did you really?
Hello, my dear. My dear, she lives only 10 minutes.
I
see.
Oh,
by the bus.
Right. Yes.
And
you're talking about the men.
Have you ever seen these things?
Yeah.
We had a most interesting time over this. It was a revelation to me how many people there were apparently educated and going about as normal people who knew absolutely nothing of the country they lived in. And one of the very interesting things that you can put it, I know we're going to pieces and we've become a permissive and wrecked society, but one of the things is so different that little the classes knew about each other, you see. And there were these a lot of times in this tour that we made, you see, we always made a great point of the horrible sweating that existed, even in spite of the Sweated Industries Board, which was in 98, been
98,
paid
yes,
before, you see, and how much it was neglected, and how little it was known, and what appalling wages they were still getting. And I had a number of lists. Editor Pankhurst was very knowledgeable on this, and she'd given me a list of what the wages were. Some I had learned from the people themselves, you see, in Belfast, Dundee, and those were both places where I'd spoken, because I couldn't believe it myself. And I'd gone to see and educate and interview my opposite number there, you see. In the Sweated Industries in Dundee, it was jute, making the jute-making.
Yes.
And the jute-making girls got as little as 10 shillings a week to live on for every purpose. And even in 1911, with the cheap food, you see, it simply wasn't
so really
possible. In the Midlands, the very lowest was the chain makers of Cradley Heath, which
yes,
you will have heard,
yes, yes,
and of which the press had really tried to get people interested. They didn't believe it, weren't interested. And there, some of the women got as little as 5 shillings a week, and they had to live at home on almost rags and scraps, they were entirely barred from promotion.
Yes.
There was a trade union rule that anything with pay that was higher than, I think it was 8 shillings a week, women were not allowed to do the job, even though they could do the job. But because it was better paid, it had to be kept for the men. And you see, I don't think people knew that sort of horror was going on.
Were there some men who supported?
I beg pardon?
Were there some men who supported woman suffrage? Did you find?
Oh yes,
but
they were nearly all in the Labour Party. The men thought it was took very little interest and had done very extraordinary little for it. And as I think I mentioned to you last time, they would refer you to the legislature and the Sweated Industries Board, and they always said that the underpayment for sweated goods was due to the fact that the women demanded such cheap underclothes, and it was the fault of the women, your own sex. So I used to get so infuriated at that, and I don't think I told you this story. Yeah. I don't think I've hardly ever mentioned it. It was most impressive. I was invited by a lady whom I, some years after this Harrogate excursion, I was invited by this lady who lived out beyond Epping Forest. I don't forget the name of the town just on the borders of Epping Forest.
Ongar, was it? Ongar, was it? Or,
yeah,
or Raintree?
No, not as far out as that.
Yes,
it
yes.
was actually, you drove through it just as you were coming into the forest.
I see, yes.
And it was for well-to-do city people, had a lot of doings there. And I knew her husband, they had a Danish name, and I knew her husband, whom I never met, was a manufacturer of underclothes. And I gave my address. I didn't like my audience at all. I thought they were not such ignorant women, but intensely selfish women, as I'd met up in Harrogate. And I told them about these rates of pay. I said, you can go yourselves and you can find out what the women are actually getting. And I mentioned this, I got this retort from somebody in the audience. It was the women who did that. And I was beginning to give my answer, which would have been correct, which of course would have been second or third hand for me, because I really didn't know the rag trade, as it was then called, the rag trade conditions, when the master of the house, who I'd taken a great fancy to, he was a most charming middle-aged man, and he jumped up and said, perhaps Dr. Fairfield would allow me to answer this, as it happens to be my source of livelihood, and I have to know all these things, the tips of my fingers. And he said, I can tell you this, that what goods are sold for in the shop has no relation whatever either to the payment that the people can get or that for their needs. And he said, you will find quite expensive shirts, £2. It was, you see, quite a lot for a shirt in those days.
Oh, yes.
He said, some of the very worst payment of the East End sweatshops is producing those shops that I and other city men are selling in the city. And if every woman in England wanted to pay more, was willing to pay more, it would simply go into the hands of the middleman. And I decline to believe that a woman had got it. And that's why I think women ought to have the vote. And we didn't bother any palliative legislation until they got the vote. Well, you see, the people had to believe them, but I saw someone looking doubtful even then. I thought it was most interesting.
Very interesting.
He gave me a number, it was 65 years ago, so I don't can't remember naturally what he did.
No.
He gave me a long list of these prices that were actually current, people were getting in the sweatshops in the East End.
Did you get any men defending you at meetings against attack?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Did you?
Quite a number. Mm. Quite a number. Mm. Both in Manchester and in nearly every town. I remember in Coventry there was a very good active little group with quite a lot of men in it. And all these places, and it was simply invaluable because I'm sure a number of the women joined up on the stage, and I said, don't, for heaven's sake, don't join anybody whose methods you don't approve of. We don't approve of anybody who doesn't think that this is an occasion for active intervention from time to time. Yeah. But if you don't, work all the harder at the constitutional methods you go in for, yeah. you see. Because we won't continue them a day yeah. after they are necessary, which ultimately turned out to be true, you see. Yeah. She dropped yeah. them at the beginning of the war.
How did your suffrage campaign, your suffrage career relate to your sister's? Because your sister followed you, did she?
Oh, yes. She, Rebecca, began writing at 18. She had her name on posters at eight, when she started at 18 years of age. Her stuff was so original and so lively.
She got connected with the Free Woman, didn't she?
Yes. Yeah. The Free Woman was one of the dubious things that wasn't entirely inside the movement, because the girl, Dora Marsden, who rang it, was a very unusual person, but she could never have worked at the Pankhursts. And she rather took the view that you must propagand all these fresh ideas to women, you see, before you trusted them with the vote. And we thought it was...
The vote has come first.
It should happen the other way around. Yes. So that was all. Yeah. But we didn't retire it. But Rebecca's work in the first things in the Free Woman was simply extraordinary, and she was only 18 to 21 yeah. when she...
Did
she
you agree about the suffrage, you two? I mean,
yes.
You didn't diverge at all?
Oh, no, not at all. Mm. And she had a great admiration for Mary Goldthorpe, you see.
Did she?
And the next thing she did, the most valuable thing was that Robert Blatchford asked her to join the Clarion. And, of course, the Clarion... Do you know the Clarion?
Oh, yes, yes. A Labour paper.
It was a Labour paper. You would think it, I suppose, rather low grade. It was quite funny, and it tried to be amusing, you
yes.
see. And Robert Blatchford had been in the army, and so he fortunately had a number of army catchwords. And a lot of men took the Clarion, who wouldn't have let an ordinary paper being seen dead with their votes in their hand. But they were getting the stuff all the same, you see.
And Rebecca wrote for the Clarion.
She wrote some very good stuff for the Clarion and attained very wise publicity. So the next thing that happened was that I had known Mrs. Lind, and I think that the two Lind daughters were just getting old enough, but Sylvia Lind was a very charming person. She was the wife of Robert Lind, the critic. And Robert Lind began to read Sissy's stuff, and he gave her a job on the Daily News. And, you see, that was very much better pay. And I think for the... Clarion, she'd been getting £1, and for the Free Woman, 18 shillings.
Yeah.
Put up her wages to £1 when she pointed out she had a lot of fares or something. But it was, that was the kind of scale it was on, you see.
So was she active with the militants? You had to keep out of the militants, didn't you?
She never... you see, we were getting onto the war by this time, you see.
Yes, yes.
And it was past 1911, it was about... it was getting on to... See, the war was 1914.
Yes. Could I ask you one more thing, Dr. Fairfield, about Catholicism and birth control? You became converted to Catholicism when? In the 1920s, was it?
Yes, it was.
Because, you see, I've seen you quoted in Parliament about your opposition to birth control.
They hated me like poison. They all made a dead set. all the birth control enthusiasts.
Mm.
But I could keep you here for another hour if I was to tell you stories about Mary Stopes.
Oh, I'd love you to one day. Could you do that, do you think? Not now.
They had, in that series on the BBC, they had Mary Stopes.
Yes.
And I had once contributed, but I didn't want my name mentioned, because I think I was still doing something for... No, it couldn't be near. See, it was only about 6 or 7 years ago. I had a godson who was a priest, and he was the secretary to British Bishop Butler.
Oh, yes.
He would have been a bishop himself when he was carried off by lung cancer when he was in his early 40s. It was most tragic. Mm. And his brother, too. Same thing, exactly. And Richard Sutherland, he was the son of old Dr. Sutherland, you know, the great opponent of Dr. Sutherland. He and I were both interviewed by two people from the BBC who... with great respect, I don't think were really very useful. They were too much after a story, you see, and it affections with their story and the view they'd formed of Mary Stopes, and they simply wiped it out. Quite simple. If one could only do that, it would be quite simple. Well, I asked them to tea, the man and the woman, and I told them, I said, I'm going to tell you the story about truth about Mary Stopes, which has never been printed, and you won't print it, and you won't disseminate it, but it's perfect too, that Mary Stopes, whose mother, oddly enough, was a teacher to my mother in Edinburgh, oh, yes. So I heard about her for a long time, and she was a brilliant, brilliant woman. And there was no mistake about her scientific ability and about, I should say, about 50% what she was writing. And I said, I knew her well over many years as an enemy, but I saw a very great deal lot of her, and I knew her friends very intimately, and her solicitor. And... I said she was about half her material was of any value, and she was genuinely sincere in everything she said. But she unfortunately was a pro-paranoid person, like you get. There was a well-known case on the BBC at present. Of somebody who really has delusions.
Yes.
Is positively deluded. Mm. Well, Mary Stopes picked up this story, realized, you see, that a lot of, tremendous lot of women needed help in birth control, needed help in with their children, and in a very large number of cases, they were not to be encouraged to have more children automatically, whatever religion they belonged to,
yes.
Because they couldn't in any case do justice to them, give them even ordinary maternal care that one would think that was a birth should be a birthright of a child. So she dealt with those, and she opened a clinic, and... But then she began to get quite crazy about birth control. And only one doctor would touch her. Dr. Jane, her husband was a consultant in Harley Street. She doesn't matter a bit.
Yes.
Suffice it, she was a very bad doctor. She had no real experience at all. And Mary Stopes was so anxious she shouldn't be smothered by unsympathetic medical opinion, that she ran the clinic with herself and a nurse, which of course was shocking, because she was getting masses of real gynecological cases, you see, some of whom certainly should not have had the pessaries and things she recommended, but in any case certainly needed a medical overhaul of examination before they were referred to anyone for a birth control technique. And she was remarked that the medical profession at that time can't really be judged for blamed for seeing her and for not supporting her.
Yes.
Because it would simply have been contrary to the whole of medical etiquette. There wasn't another case in which anybody with as little knowledge was reporting as much as she did. And anyway, she carried on like this. And she had several very sort of, I was going to say abortive wrong love affairs, and that was the wrong word.
Yeah.
different...
unsuccessful love affairs, yes.
Yes, unsuccessful love affairs. Mm. And that of no interest now, really,
yeah.
poor woman, and was trying to live her own life and doing a big public service. But she also had... when she married... Oh, yes. When she married Roe, H.V. Roe,
yes.
You see, and was going to have a baby in herself, it was just too much. She tipped over, and for the next two or three years, she simply, to those who knew her, including her solicitors, and she changed her solicitors either two or three times in the course of this litigation, and was a source of anecdote, unseemly anecdote in the temple for years and years. And I'd started to read for the bar. So I was getting the backwash, you see, through the lawyers, as well as hearing the medical side of this. And she insisted on... giving advice to these people when it was really quite beyond her and quite wrong. And she went quite crazy about her own child.
Yes.
Well, doctors, this is, will you regard this, please, as not to be put down in paper?
Yes.
I think you'll agree.
Yes, yes.
I'm not telling you, because I never treated her as a doctor, okay, near that. I'm simply treating her of the medical facts that were in a small circle, common knowledge.
Yes. Yes.
See, and that I got so many confirmations of that I knew they were true. Doctors found she had a contracted pelvis. Well, the doctors were anxious to do a premature labor. She was so anxious to prove that she was a marvelous mother, you see, and knew everything about motherhood, that she said they were talking nonsense and that she was perfectly healthy and that she was able to bring this child into the world. And a tragedy happened, and she had a long and painful delivery, and the baby was dead when it was born. And was, you see... she must have known that that was really her fault.
Yeah.
And it was, she simply went crazy. She was convinced that the Jesuits had bribed the staff of the nursing home, Farm Street. Farm Street knew this, and to do them justice, I don't always love and approve of Farm Street, but they behaved extremely well over Mary Stopes. And when they learned that she had this delusion on them, they made special reference in their daily prayers to her. You see, the whole community were praying for her that the baby should be healthy. And instead of this, you see, it died, and they were accused. I don't think anybody was silly enough to print it. I don't know, it was printed later, that the Jesuits had... had bribed the nursing staff. So, and there were also a number of other quite grotesque things she did. And when she found herself pregnant again in a little while, then the poor Mr. Rowe, who was a very sane person, was not allowed to intervene, apparently, at all. And she insisted on making a contract with the proprietor of the nursing home where she had to go. She knew she had to go and have a cesarean section, you yeah. see. And that no Roman Catholic should be employed on the premises, even as a kitchen maid, even in the kitchen, or in any capacity whatever. Well, I don't know what else she said to them, but I do know this, that she went up one side, Harley Street, and down the other, and nobody would take her under those conditions. The medical press said it was too dangerous, that what would happen to their reputation if there was another disaster. And you never can tell, of course, that a baby is 100% yeah. safe. There's always a 0.99 yeah. chance that there's some obstacle to it. And no doctor would touch her. Well, she ultimately found some place at Bristol. And she went down to Bristol to have the baby. And this is one of the most extraordinary facts, that one of the nurses, it was an influenza epidemic, and one of the nurses, or several of the nurses, got ill, and the proprietress of the home, it may have been that she was ill herself. I don't think she was at the time. I think she too had influenza. And the substitute didn't know about this contract, you see. And a nurse who nursed me when I had a major operation in London a couple of years later said, "Do you know Mary Stokes?" And I said, "Oh, yes, poor old dear, of course I know her." And she said, "Well, she's quite mad, isn't she?" So I said, "What do you know about her?" "Oh," she said, "I was in the theatre when she had her cesarean section." It does show the futility of human wishes by this extraordinary intervention of Providence, my nurse had been sent by an agency, and she was a Catholic. And she told me that this woman, they all knew she was quite mad. Once when a nurse came into the room to bring the baby in to be fed, and the baby, she put out her hand to grasp thing, something or something, and Mary Stope shouted out to the maid, "You'll drop my baby, I'll sue you for life." And the nurse stared at her in amazement, and then the proprietors came back and they were told what the, my nurse wasn't told, but I believe the others were told, how careful they must be with her, and that she was not quite right. Well, she had the baby, and she never had another. I believe she wanted to have another. She never had another baby. And she dressed it. Oh, she was quite extraordinary. It was a little boy. I think she had it dressed as a girl for about 2 years. And all kinds of mad things went on, you see. And I wondered if they would have anything about this in this. I told the people that I don't know if they believed me. They probably didn't. Because they really were rather stupid. It sounds impossible. It's coming from the BBC. Serial. Certainly the woman was. And poor thing, she was like that with intervals, and she died. And she gave the poor boy a most frightful time. He was, I don't think he could even go to any ordinary school. He had to be so carefully educated. And when he grew up, he fell in love with a very nice and very suitable girl. And when he brought her home to his mother, she wouldn't speak to them. I don't think she ever spoke to them again.
Yes, that's right. But how did your becoming a Roman Catholic affect your attitude to birth control? Had you always been against it?
I was... about the birth control business, my colleagues were not in sympathy with me, and I was too much taken with the idea of the natural law, which I now have ceased to believe in. I don't mind, I've even told the priest here and the bishop, that I cannot accept the rule that if a mother's life is being in serious danger, that she's obliged to sacrifice both herself and the baby. Because you can't get people to understand that if the baby is viable, there's no problem, you see.
Yes. Yes.
No religious problem at all.
Yes.
But if the baby is going to be simply 2 and 3 months,
mm.
what is the good of sacrificing a mother's life for a 2 or 3 months-old fetus?
Mm. Yes.
Do you see? And they won't see that. You see it's a simple issue, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. But there was a proposal in the 1920s, wasn't there, for welfare centres to be able to give birth control information, wasn't there? And you opposed that, didn't you? Was that because of your Catholicism?
It was partly that, and partly because the sort of permissive idea that was growing, and I was so afraid, as so many people were, that if you got that, what would happen today? It would happen today.
Mm-hmm.
And that you would get people, fancy the judges supporting. Louts of 18 to 21 who would seduce a girl, make a girl of 13 pregnant.
So it wasn't... Did it have much to do with your Catholicism, your attitude? Or
Yes, it had a great deal to do with it.
Mm.
I would have been much more selective. Mm. And now, as you know, there is an enormous split within the church.
Yes.
And I don't know, you won't know, because it only was published in our Catholic Medical Journal, which is here, that our president, Dr. Reynolds, who has a very good general practice, is too old now.
Mm.
He had a wonderful general practice in Newport, Monmouthshire, and he has a son who's on this staff here. And
I'm very sorry, but she goes to rehabilitation.
Oh, nurse, I'm...